struggling to. Oh, the tribunal. The tribunal. When I see you, I see the broadcast of this event on television that I watched intensely and looked at your performance. And I was saying to people that I have confidence now in this tribunal because you indicated to us already the contingency measures that you have considered as well to ensure that we do not just process or pass the legislation, but that we are also adequately prepared to make sure that the main beneficiaries can benefit from what it is that we process. Honourable members, can I just verify or check with you? Do we have any apologies? We don't have any apologies. Can I then go into the next item on the agenda to just put before you what we are going to deliberate upon today? We will look at the National Credit Amendment Bill. Honourable Tablange, this is a very strange bill that is before us. It is what we call a committee bill. So the portfolio committee is bringing this bill to Parliament. And therefore, we have to give responsibility to the department. We can't give the committee members of the MA an opportunity to come present the bill to us. So we have advocate Van der Merwe, who as an advocate has been working with the portfolio committee on that. And she's almost like presenting it to us on behalf of the portfolio committee. But then we also have our colleagues from the Department of Trade and Industry, and also the National Credit Tribunal. We have the chair of the tribunal with us at the opportune time. We'll introduce ourselves to you. To the members of DTI, you would not know about the fact that the Honourable Tablange, has been delegated by his party to replace the Honourable Jacob Lomt as the delegate from the Western Cape to this committee. We have welcomed him in previous meetings, but just to introduce him to you. If I don't welcome him, it's because we've done it. Honourable Blanche, we work very closely with DTI. They have 13 entities in the department, so they appear to us more regularly than any of the other committees, other departments that we're dealing with in this committee. You know, it's DERCO, DTI, and tourism, but they come more because of the number of entities in the Department of Trade and Industry. We also, honorable members, have three sets of minutes before us that we'll have to adopt prior to us adjourning this meeting, which will in all probability be our last meeting for 2018. So I welcome you warmly. I will, when the opportunity arises to raise questions, then introduce the members of the committee to you. But can we give an opportunity to the people sitting in front on my left to then introduce yourselves so that the committee members can know who is presenting to us today? My understanding from Advocate Van der Merwe is that she will do the initial presentation and then the department staff. I won't refer to the NCT, but include them under the department staff, then they will form any gaps. We have agreed that we would want to go through the presentation as rapidly as we can without taking away any of the important content, but give you members an opportunity to engage with what has been presented to us. If we could, can we start the introduction from there?
Thank you. Good morning, members. I'm Ashley Charmaine von Amara. I'm with the Parliamentary Legal Office.
Good morning, honourable members. I'm Dr. Evelyn Masoja from the DTI in the Consumer and Corporate Regulation Division.
Good morning, Chair and members. I'm Lisiwa Mashapa with the National Credit Regulator.
Good morning, honourable members. My name is Ntupang Ngoweni and I'm from the NCR.
Good morning, honourable members. My name is Nomsa Mutsikhari. I'm with the National Credit Regulator.
You should tell us whether you're the CEO or not.
Sorry about honourable chair. I'm the CEO. Thank you.
Good morning, chair, honourable members. My name is Professor Joseph Maseko from the National Consumer Tribunal. I've had too much regulator, almost imported myself.
George Naidu, I'm the Parliamentary Liaison, Ministry of Trade and Industry.
Good morning, Chair and members. I'm Adira Bolsing from Polarity Consulting.
Good morning, I'm Kabir Bihari. I'm CEO of Ubiquity Artificial Intelligence.
Morning, my name is Timbani Badanyana. I'm protecting content as well for the committee.
Allow me to just welcome our acting content advisor that has just spoken to us. I have just been introduced to him, and that's why I was a bit late also for the meeting. But he has been with Parliament for some time, working in the office of the Secretary to Parliament, and has now been given to us in an acting capacity as the content advisor of this committee. We welcome you and look forward to working with you, sir.
Hi, I'm Christine Milan from the NCRF, the National Clothing Retail Federation.
Morning, members. Mr. Zampumlani Daimu from Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
Good morning, I'm Anina Berdros from the Marginal Bank Lenders Association.
Can I just check if we have any visitors at the back, not staff? Please introduce yourself.
Good morning, honourable members. My name is Yana Pali. I'm also from the Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
Good morning, members. This is Vishal Jaffe from EFICO, the Parliamentary Advisor to the Banking Association, Nedbank and Microfinance South Africa.
The other two people there? Oh, they stopped. Okay. I couldn't see your head. I just saw them. Sure. Honourable members, we have the presentation that has been shared with us last week already, that the Advocates Fund of Maverick is going to read us through. And because we have the other visitors here, to just say we've received all the submissions, and we have the submissions here. We're not going to go through each of the submissions now, but there would be a summary that has been done that contains part of the presentation. Please, Advocate, you in your hands.
Thank you, Chairperson. If I can start on the first slide that has wording, it's numbered slide 2. These first two slides are more the general comments from the public, general concerns, and I will go into more detail into the slides that follow. This first slide more or less indicates the support that there is for the bill. The last submitted there, Ms. Mbutelezi, indicated that we should cancel all debts and have no monetary system. I've included it on this slide to make it very clear that all submissions have have been considered. Of course, unfortunately, that proposal would be quite unconstitutional and we will not be able to go there. I'm not going to speak to all the support. Members can read for themselves what the public indicated about the support. There was some on the next slide, slide three, there was some concern about the fact that there might be procedural weaknesses, and these I will go into more detail with the specific slides. The impact on the industry, there's also a slide that specifically deals with that. So the microfinance of South Africa indicated that they are there and they can assist these consumers, and therefore the bill is actually unnecessary. But it is quite clear that microfinance South Africa is there currently, and yet there is currently a problem. So clearly it's not sufficient, and that is why the bill was deemed to be necessary. A long implementation timeline. Now, it is so that this bill cannot be implemented the moment that it is passed by Parliament and assented to by the President. There's so many systems and things that have to be put into place. But if there is not a starting point, we will never get to the point where these consumers are assisted. So the Department will also speak a little bit more to the committee on what the plans are in relation to implementation, so that there can be an assurance that, yes, it might be a lengthy process. We might be looking at like 12 months before the systems will be in place, but there is something in place already. The next slide is a concern about that the regulator might be replacing your debt counsellors. That debt counsellors are actually more suited to this assistance. Now, the problem, of course, with debt counsellors is that they are costly. So when, for a debt review, if a consumer goes to a debt counsellor, there is a cost that is paid to the debt counsellor. I mean, it's not something that is happening for free. We are aware of that. Because there is a cost to it, it means that your debt counsellors do not provide debt review services to certain consumers. And those are, and this has come about after consultation that the portfolio committee had with debt counsellors, that is where more or less that 7,500 limit of salary comes to play. Anyone who earns less than 7,500 or 7,500 on the dot is simply not economically viable as a client to a debt counsellor. So there is no duplication of roles. It is the group that are excluded simply because they don't have enough money. They are the people covered by this bill. There were also proposals for a levy that could be raised to rather pay the debt counsellor, so that it is still a debt counsellor does it, but through a levy. There was something like that in the past, and the department will speak to that attempt and why that is not a viable proposition. But you must also keep in mind that a subsidy cannot be imposed through a Section 76 or Section 75 bill. It must be done by the Minister of Finance through a money bill. So it's a total different process. But like I said, the department will speak to why the levy was not something that is in fact viable. If I go on to the next slide, that is then comments related to the role of the regulator and the tribunal. Things about concerns about the independence and the impartiality of the regulator, and the concern that these functions are in conflict with existing functions of the regulator. Now, the role of the regulator has very carefully been considered, but we need to keep in mind that the regulator is a creature of statute. So what statute determines the regulator must do is what the regulator must do. So if existing functions are changed by legislation, that will become their new function. So they cannot be any, it is not possible to have a conflict of functions with a legislative creature of, you know, a creature of statute, because the statute determines what they must do. In relation to the independence and impartiality, any place where there would be conflicting interest, these were very carefully considered, and I give a couple of examples there. In clause 3, where we talk about appointment of persons who specifically will act as debt intervention officers. So it won't be the current later. But specific provision is made for people to be appointed who will be specifically, exclusively dealing with these debt intervention applicants. Where there's a dispute, the tribunal is the party that becomes involved as an independent adjudicator. And I've also indicated there the two clauses where this arrives. Then, still on the role of the NCR, that is where I've just now mentioned the issue of the capacity, and the department will also speak to that capacity. There was a request for strict timelines. There's in general a concern from the public that government doesn't work as fast as it should be working. But the Act, the bill does propose a number of timelines that must be put into place. So I've also indicated there clauses 8 and 9. Set timelines that the regulator must comply with. And of course, implementation of a bill is always subject to parliamentary oversight. So it will be for Parliament, especially since this is a parliamentary bill, to make sure that the implementation of this bill does happen the way Parliament envisages that it must happen. So yes, there will be an oversight role as well. Then the Law Society of South Africa made a comment about judicial oversight. And I struggled with their comment a little bit because I could not understand what they meant by it. They referred us to the case of University of Stellenbosch Legal Aid Clinic versus the Minister of Justice. And I realized that we are talking about two different things. What happened in that case is that there was no interference from a court body, a court or a tribunal, any judicial body. There was no interference. It was left up to the clerk of the court to make a decision. Now, that I understand there is no judicial oversight. But the tribunal is, in terms of the constitution, a judicial body. So there is judicial oversight. And I think maybe the Law Society lost sight of that, to think that if the tribunal comes in, there is no judicial oversight. But it's not the case. The tribunal is a judicial body, and there will be judicial oversight. The role of the regulator and courts, I'm now on slide number 7. There was a proposal that both your magistrates' court and your tribunal may hear this, so to provide for easy access. Now, the intention, of course, by bringing your tribunal in is to limit costs. Magistrates are expensive. It is simply that is how it is. But clause 11 actually does provide that where a matter is already before a magistrate's court, then that magistrate's court can hear the matter for a debt intervention. So it is already a process provided, but it's only applicable where it is already in the magistrate's court. So if you have to choose still which forum you are going to, you will have to go to the tribunal, and that is because of the implications of cost. Then in respect of the criteria, I'm now on slide 8, there was a concern about there was no indication how your figures of 7,500 and the 50,000 were arrived at. And this is the criteria that limits who can be an applicant. The 7,500, I've explained before, was in consultation with the debt counsellors, because that was the bracket of people that weren't being given a service by debt counsellors because it is not cost effective for them. And the 50,000 is taken from administration. So your administration measure has a 50,000 limit, so it is aligned to that, taking an existing example. There was also a concern that this would be overly complicated. This whole process is overly complicated. The problem that this bill faces is that you are dealing with two competing constitutional rights. You're sitting with the right to property on the one hand and the right to equality on the other hand. And to balance those two rights and make sure that we are limiting, that limitation is fair and equitable, it does mean that you need to bring processes into place. And this is then where the role of the regulator will be critical, to communicate to the public how this will work, what the public must do, and where the public can go from step 1 to step 2, and what must be done. It is also, however, important to remember that the largest portion of the debt intervention measure duplicates the debt review process. So it takes the debt review process that is currently in the Act and it uses the exact same process. Now, debt review has been working. It's clear that that is currently there. It's working. So I don't understand why, how we could really say that it is overly complicated. There's one additional step, which is the issue regarding extinguishing, and that is where we have to be very careful how the process unfolds, because that affects someone's property rights if in the end the debt is extinguished. So there has to be clear steps and processes in place for that. Then there was also a concern that there must be participation by credit providers. Now, the biggest challenge that the committee, the portfolio committee, faced when they published the bill, the initial draft of the bill, was this criteria, that there is not sufficient processes to allow for participation by credit providers. So the bill then goes every step of the way. It includes the credit providers before any decision is going to be made, before any hearing is going to be made. After a decision is made, credit providers are involved. And I've then also listed the clauses there for members so that it is quite clear where this participation is in fact set out. There's also a concern about unsecured credit and the fact that this is now discriminatory because you only focus on unsecured credit. And for instance, your microfinance members will only be unsecured credit, and thus they will be affected the most. The concern about unsecured versus secured credit is that with secured credit, there is an asset that can be used to defray the debt. It must be treated differently. It is not something that, if you take a secured asset and you suddenly say to the credit provider of that secured asset, well, no, you can't touch this asset, but now we will pay you off over 5 years. Or you can't touch this asset and we will actually, the debt will be extinguished. There's a certain unfairness in that that is not the same with the debt that is unsecured. So that was the reason why it is limited to unsecured debt. Now, also, this is an absolutely new process in South Africa, especially the question of extinguishing. So it is something that might develop over time. But to add, especially where you might be extinguishing the debt, to include secured debt in that is something that should rather develop over time and should be considered very carefully before that route is taken, so that there is no unfairness towards the credit provider. The next slide deals with a concern about zero rating. Now, what this is about is that there are two clauses, actually there's three clauses. The one deals with the regulations that gives the guidelines to these. The two clauses, and you'll see there from the second bullet point, it's the sections 86, clause 12, and section 87, clause 14, says that your court, that's clause 12, and the tribunal, clause 14, can consider the interest that is being charged on an agreement and may reduce that interest to allow a consumer to be able to actually repay that debt. Now, this is currently practice. There's an agreement with the industry, with the regulator, and that is what happens in practice. In order to see if a person can repay the debt through debt review, there's an adjustment of the interest rate. It doesn't automatically go down to zero. It starts, if the interest rate is 10, they will look at 9.5, then 9, and to make sure that this consumer can repay within 5 years. The problem is that the way that the Act currently reads, even if a credit provider agrees to, let's say, 0%, the court cannot make that order because nothing in the Act allows the court to make that order. So it is necessary to make sure that because the magistrate's court and the tribunal are creatures of statute, that the orders that they may make are in fact captured in the bill. So that is why it is there. Now, the concern that a lot of people have, and it is raised here as well, and in fact, National Treasury assisted the Portfolio Committee with the wording because they were concerned about the effect on the financial market. So the wording that is currently there is proposed by National Treasury. And the clause that deals with the regulation, they specifically say what the minister must take into account when the minister makes guidelines for magistrates and tribunal members to take into account when affecting this reduction of interest rate. So standard, the practices in the industry taken into account, the existing agreement that is there between this, the industry and the regulator must be taken into account. So all of these things are clearly spelled out in the bill and will be very carefully handled. There was also a request just for that it should only be for the 60 months, but that is already the case in the bill. The next slide 11, speaks then to the extinguishing of debt, and there was a concern about deprivation of property. Now, I've already indicated that this bill treads a very thin line between two rights that are protected by the Constitution, property and the right to equality. And it is so that if there is a reduction of the amount to be paid, if there is a lengthening of the period within which to pay, if there is an extinguishing of the debt, all of that constitutes deprivation of property. There's no doubt about it. But then Section 25(1) of the Constitution says that that may happen. It is allowed by our Constitution to deprive someone of property, provided that it's not arbitrarily done. Now, on this aspect, the Portfolio Committee also obtained an opinion from Advocate Trengo, the senior counsel, and he went through the rationale for the bill, which is your substantive reason, which is one leg of arbitrary. The second leg of not being arbitrary is your process. And then the third leg is that it must be a law of general application. This bill ticks all those boxes. It is a law of general application. There is a substantive reason, there's a rationale why these two rights have to be balanced. And the process, in fact, in his view, was so carefully put there that it will be a difficult process. So the bill has been very careful to make sure that the process in itself and the end result will not be an arbitrary result. And therefore, this bill should pass constitutional muster. The next slide, slide 12, deals with mandatory life insurance. And there was a concern that there might not be a product available. And now you're making it mandatory. And because you're making it mandatory and there isn't a product available, it means that a person can't take out a loan like this. Now, again, this is where National Treasury also had a concern. So based on their recommendation, the bill currently actually delegates this requirement of mandatory life insurance to the minister to promulgate by way of regulation. So that this is not something that the bill introduces. It will only be done through regulation. And the Minister of Finance must be consulted. So there will be consultations between the two relevant ministers. And unless there is a product available, there will not be regulation. So I don't think it is a valid concern, but there is a measure in place for that. The next slide, 13, deals with financial literacy training. And in fact, here, the request was for it to be made more stringent than what the bill currently provides for. If a debt is going to be suspended, there must be financial literacy training. That is a requirement. But the bill also provides that when a person applies for this measure, the debt intervention officer at the regulator must provide counselling and must provide access, must give the person guidance to have access to financial literacy training. So it's clear that at that stage, the application stage is not compulsory, but there will be guidance given and there will be a referral to that. The problem is that it's costly to provide this kind of training. So there might have to be a levy that is raised. And again, a levy is a money bill. So that is not something that can be done in this bill. The bill does provide that there is, when the regulations are being done, there must be consultation with the Minister of Finance. Because in fact, Treasury at this moment is working with this type of program already. It is being set into place. So this is something that over time again can be developed, and maybe in a few years' time when this is set up, then the applicants stage where this counselling can be made compulsory as well. At this point in time, it is just there's a bit of a cost concern to give it to all applicants. So the bill currently just provides for those applicants where the debt will be suspended. So in other words, the most serious cases power of the minister to change the amount, the salary, 7,500 and the 50,000, and to look at the whole application of this bill and the impact of this bill. It is not something that takes away the function of Parliament, and that is the only thing that Parliament cannot delegate. Parliament is allowed to delegate. In fact, there is court cases, more than enough court cases, and I've mentioned the one there, the Executive Council of Western Cape, the 1995 case, so it's long established that there is nothing in the Constitution which prohibits Parliament from delegating subordinated regulatory authority to other bodies. It is necessary for effective lawmaking. The rationale for allowing the minister to adjust these parameters is that 10 years from now, a salary of 7,500 might be laughable, and there might be a larger group of people who are not able to afford the services of a debt counsellor. And to bring that back to Parliament for a whole legislative process just does not make sense, does not make for effective legislation, as is stated in that case. So furthermore, the minister is required to bring those regulations to Parliament. So there is a direct oversight from Parliament's side to see that what is being, the regulations that the minister will make is in fact complying and falls and has been duly considered, so that the parameters aren't moved up and down arbitrarily. And then the last was just a comment, actually, and from the Debt Counsellors Association, that I agree with. The rationale for those two numbers is simply to determine the group of qualifying consumers. On slide 15, dealing with offences, there was a concern that why do you want to make all of these things offences? Now, first off, the debt intervention is something that we cannot afford. South Africa cannot afford for it to be abused. So if someone makes a false statement deliberately, intentionally, makes a false statement in order to qualify for debt intervention, or plays around with their financial circumstances in order to qualify, that will totally scupper the purpose of the debt intervention measure. And it is important that that is made an offence, so that people can understand that it is serious. The other offences that have been added are things that have been long-standing concerns that the department has raised over and over and over again. For instance, the issue of not registering. The one thing that was mentioned by the department is that at the moment, illegal lenders cannot be arrested for not being registered because it's not an offence. So how do we clamp down? We have to arrest them for retaining a person's ID book, and then the sentence and the subsequent finding is related to retaining an ID book, not to the actual bad thing that is happening, namely a person that is unregistered and that acts as a credit provider, probably and most often to the detriment of the consumers that person is assisting. Now, if that person is clever and does not retain their ID book, then you can't do anything. So that person can just operate without being registered, without being subject to the necessary oversight. So there is a rationale for it being made an offence. It hasn't been offences before, and it's clear that practice requires it to be an offence. There was a concern that a debt counsellor who does not report would be sent to prison for up to 10 years. This is not correct. That is, in fact, not made an offence at all. Nothing to do with reckless lending is currently made an offence. It probably should be, because it is a big problem. But we could not make it an offence in this bill, because reckless lending in itself is a very difficult finding to make. There was, in fact, a case where the tribunal indicated to the committee when this was discussed, where the regulator was of the view something was reckless lending. But when the tribunal considered the facts given by the credit provider and how the credit provider determined reckless lending, the tribunal had to say that this isn't reckless lending. So something that is so unclear cannot be made an offence, and it is, in fact, not made an offence. Association. So there is definitely no substance to that concern. Then slide 16, the impact of the bill on the credit market. There were a number of concerns raised on this. The fact that it was intended initially to be a once-off measure. Some of these consumers will now be excluded from the credit market because the risk is too big. It will create a moral hazard and people will stop paying their debts. Now, all of these aspects have been considered. The concern about a once-off measure, that actually changed because that is what the public asked. When this bill was discussed the first time in the portfolio committee, the public indicated that this can never be a once-off measure. The need out there is simply too high and it is a continuous need. And that is why the portfolio committee had to adjust, because you have to give due consideration to public inputs. To say that people will be excluded, all of these people are currently able to apply for debt review. So why would that be such a big problem? The issue of extinguishing is such a difficult process. It takes 2 years of that debt being suspended. The consumer must attend financial literacy training. The consumer must present his or her financials twice in those 2 years, well, once per year, for the regulator to determine whether they can't actually pay that debt. That by the time it comes to extinguishing, the way Advocate Trengover explained it, it is such a small amount that the credit provider will not even matter. It will not even matter to the credit provider. It's not the type of amount that the credit provider will actually go to court for. So there's no reason for these people to be excluded from the credit market. And about a moral hazard, the portfolio committee specifically visited the United Kingdom, where a similar program is in place. One of the questions that they very pertinently asked was whether there was, in fact, an increase in consumers refusing to pay their debts, and whether there was any unforeseen circumstances that started arising, things that wasn't intended. And the United Kingdom's response was that there was no adverse effect on the market whatsoever. And then, as I've also indicated, the process to extinguish debt review is currently in existence. There's simply a duplication of that. We can't say that would change. It's there already. The only big change is that of extinguishing. And as I've explained, it is such a difficult process. It is something that will really just affect that consumer that really can in any event not pay, doesn't have assets that can be attached. There is no way of getting that money from them. It is intended to give that person the relief that someone who has assets can get through sequestration. There were some procedural concerns raised, and this is on slide 17, it's the last slide. There was a concern about that people would have wanted an opportunity to comment on the entirety of the revised bill. Now, the problem is Parliament, when it amends legislation, every time have to advertise the whole of that legislation? Because remember, those amendments are made because of public input. So you receive the public input, you make amendments. If Parliament is required to advertise that whole bill every time, we will never pass legislation in either house. And in fact, I'm referring there to a court case where the court said they accept that this was relation to regulations, but the same principle applies. They said that there's no obligation to re-advertise for comment unless there's a change in a material aspect. Now, those material aspects were re-advertised on more than one occasion. So there was absolutely sufficient participation by the public, and they had an opportunity to comment on every new material aspect in the bill. There was also a concern about a socio-economic impact assessment. Now, it must be kept in mind that this is not a requirement for a committee bill. This is something that is brought in by cabinet. It is part of the quality control of legislation. So this bill is from the legislative process. There is no criticism that can be given against this bill in respect of a socio-economic impact assessment because it is not a requirement. But that having been said, the Portfolio Committee requested National Treasury, who did through a company called 8020, impact assessment was part of the reason why the bill was limited. So a number, the group that it would have affected was further limited because of that impact assessment. So it is not correct to say that there was no impact assessment. It was done and the results were taken into account and resulted into further amendments. There was a concern or a proposal that there should be an impact study within the first 6 months of the bill. Now, Clause 13 requires the Minister to review the impact of Section 87A and must, within 3 years, table a report in the National Assembly. 6 months is very short to have any data to determine an impact. So that is why the proposal is for 36 months to have. So there is, in fact, a legislatively required impact assessment that must be done, and that will then be tabled by the Minister. Chair, at this point, if I may hand over to the DDG to just speak to those slides where it relates more to the implementation and the policy.
Thank you very much, Africa. Just before you take over, DDG, can I just say that, look, honourable members, what we've gone through is an assessment of the legalities that we need to do that the lawyer has done. But in that, there were particular questions raised as well vis-a-vis the practicality. And that's what it is.
Thank you, Chair. In terms of the specific areas that the advocate indicated, she indicated the issues around implementation, the capacity of the NCR and the NCT, and the footprint in terms of location, and there was an issue around the levy or subsidy. So, Chair, I'm not going to go into too much detail, given that you've already alluded to the time restrictions, but I'm going to talk to broadly how we have envisaged the whole implementation. If there is a need for further details, the committee will let us know, then we'll provide further information. In terms of the implementation and capacity, it is in our view, and we have already said this to the Portfolio Committee of Trade and Industry, that the NCR and the NCT are established institutions, they are regulators, and they have experience. In terms of debt review, that's the mechanism that the NCR regulates. They are aware of the processes, the monitoring tools, and everything that talks to debt review. So there is that experience, also as the custodian of their legislation. So that intervention is not going to be a purely new initiative, given that it's a replica of the review with some additional amendments and the target group. Now, when you look at the National Consumer Tribunal, I like the opening you did, Chair, about you saw them and in terms of the capacity and the mechanisms that they have to mitigate different challenges. I see the National Consumer Tribunal as a machinery. They have capacity, they deal with massive cases, and they have mastered the ability to deal with volumes of cases. And also, with the way they do their work, they have also gained much credibility in terms of how they are seen operating as a court in many instances. And we are confident that just by the mere virtue of these two institutions being where they are and what they represent, they have established themselves in the market. And secondly, in terms of numbers, we have taken a decision in a principle as a collective with them that we will not talk too much about the figures. We have estimates. The challenge with a new initiative is that you're talking estimations because you still need to test it on the ground. We have estimated figures that we have worked around in terms of staffing, ICT requirements, locational issues. So those things are covered in terms of what do we envisage as the initial starting point. And in terms of the starting point, because of the infrastructure that will be built in and the staffing requirements, it's going to be massive in the first year, and then it will be lower going forward. So we foresee that the investment required for the first period will be quite high, and then going forward it will be lesser, because we'll be looking at the infrastructure system, the ICT, and then the bringing in new members for the tribunal, additional members, those that that intervention officers as well. So that will require additional funding
And we also looked at the sources of that funding in terms of, apart from the allocation of National Treasury, where else are we going to get the funding? And there are sources of funding. One of them is the payment distributing agency process that we have in the department. There's a policy that we have with the NCR that allows them to collect certain fees on the payment distributing agency. So that will also support the financial literacy program. And we are also looking at other ways to raise funding from their side. So we don't want to solely depend on the allocation. So this is one another area that we have explored as a collective in terms of how are we going to raise further funding to make sure that this is a success. So the reason why I'm indicating that is just to show that there is a lot of thinking that has gone behind this. And with the current capacity and experience, we are also looking at more ways to make this more successful once it comes into effect. On the practical side, currently the NCT and the NCR, they are working on the interfaces of their IT systems. So they've started in certain areas to build their capacity. So we're looking at how we are going to work on the systems. And in terms of reach, broadly on the implementation of that intervention, with their other functions, they have ways to reach the consumers, whether from the roadshows, the partnerships with other institutions, and we are going to use this mechanism as well going forward. We are also looking at using post offices, because post offices are for the people and they are accessible. We are also looking at working with consumer protection offices in provinces to see how we can use them to station some of the infrastructure to ensure that there's access for people in various areas, especially our low-income earners. And right now, as I speak, the NCR has a project manager that they've appointed for this process who is busy looking at the project plan for the implementation of this intervention. And we also went further to look at other processes, the processes of how to do the application. We are thinking about the regulations, how they are going to look, and the forms that will be required, and in terms of the step-by-step processes. Say, for example, by the tribunal, when a particular member looks at the process. And I think what is important to highlight is that this will not be too much of departures from their current processes. It won't be like new things. It's just that it will be additions to what they have. Like when you bring in new debt application, debt intervention officers, it will be like a new process, but then they know the process of how debt counselors currently work at this instance. So this is a broad frame, Chair, in terms of how we see the resourcing of this. And yes, I have avoided talking to numbers, but we have estimated figures that if they are required, we can provide. And in terms of financial literacy itself, that's another area we had to give an indication to the committee about in the previous session. The bill provides for financial literacy. The first one is counseling, which is in section 86A, 5A, and then financial literacy program, which is more of a training, which is in section 87A, 2B, Roman figure 2. And these training interventions, they'll come in different ways. For instance, the counseling will use your telephonic approach. You can have counseling face-to-face. We will look at using radio sessions as part of that education. And there will be roadshows. We envisage that for financial literacy, we'll also use the capacity of other institutions, like your CETAS. As Advocate indicated, National Treasury has a program on financial literacy. We'll also piggyback on that. So it will be partnership-based as well. We'll make it as wide as possible. And also currently the NCR has its own programs that look at this, and we also envisage that there will be financial literacy officers that are employed to look at organizing and coordinating all these. And we also foresee that we'll also use the National Lottery Commission and the Consumer Protection Offices. So we'll make it as wide as possible. So we have thought about this, and we think that it is practical, and it is something that both institutions are in a capacity to do, especially the NCR.
I'll treat them a bit differently. The levy, as Advocate was saying, we as a department, we've moved away from the issue of levies because the levies are money bill related and they are not in our mandate. They're in the mandate of the National Treasury. It's not something that, meaning the minute you bring that in, then the bill becomes a money bill. So we are not looking at levies. When you look at a subsidy, that can be like a grant. Even there, our funding model is different. We don't give grants per se. We do have incentives, but they've got certain criteria and they serve particular purposes. And we think that this will be costly also to the fiscus, and the administration of managing a subsidy will be a challenge. So we have moved away from that, and we something that we will not consider. We do note what the stakeholders have said about that, but it's not something that we think we should even consider as a process to debt intervention. And for we think the approach of the NCR addressing this through different funding mechanisms like the national allocation, sourcing those debt intervention at officers is sufficient. So we don't need to go the route of subsidies and so on. So we think that, Chair, with the bill as it is, with the mechanism put in place, we are sufficiently covered to address this debt intervention mechanism. And as a last point, most of the comments were talking about existing infrastructure, whether it's from the banks, debt counselors themselves, to say they have existing infrastructure, they have their interventions. But the truth is, our people are suffering right now. There is not enough support for them. And as much as others may see this as a way to make further income or profit, as government, we have an interest for the people. So we think that this bill, as it is, it's protecting the vulnerable who cannot speak for themselves. Thank you.
Thank you very much, DDG. The worst thing that can happen is when you stutter and fumble when you present something to us. And I must say, from where I'm sitting, I feel very comfortable with the way in which you have covered the broad areas that we have raised in our previous deliberations. I notice members already giving their hands, raising their hands, but I want to make sure that we deal with the process here first. CEO of NCR, would you have anything that you would want to add? And then I'm going to come to you, Prof, from the NCT.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. The DDG did make mention of the fact that as the NCR already, we do understand how debt counseling works. And in terms of the debt intervention bill, it is envisaged that NCR will be performing the functions of a debt counselor to a large extent before we even get to extinguishing any debt. Because in terms of extinguishing, that will be the very last resort. And in terms of debt counseling, the advantage is that if NCR performs that function for this target group, the service will be provided free of charge. And debt counseling does work. Unfortunately, it does not work for this group of people because they have indicated themselves that it's not viable for them to take on these consumers. Debt counseling at the moment, through debt counseling, credit providers have been able to date, get an amount of about 50 billion rand since the inception of debt counseling. So debt counseling does work. However, it only works for people who can afford to pay debt counseling fees and PDA fees. On average, on a monthly basis, about 900 million gets to be distributed to credit providers through debt counseling. And this is money that would otherwise have been written off by credit providers to a large extent. And therefore, I mean, through this mechanism, we believe as the NCR that this intervention can work. The DDG also made mention of, you know, how NCR will be able to access the NCR. And she spoke about walk-ins. There'll be, you know, through telephones, emails. We'll also make use of provincial protection offices that are already in existence. We are also going to develop cell phone apps. We will look at anything and everything, Honorable Chair. to make sure that we are able to get this information through and be accessible to this target group. I think I will stop here. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Thanks, CEO. Prof.
Thanks, Chair. I think our colleagues have presented everything adequately, because today we are only responding to what the process established under the NCOP banner, under this committee's banner, when we went out to present on behalf of the committee. And then they came back with these are the comments that were elicited, and then the comments that we are making for the committee in the presentation is just saying what our own technical point of view is on each of these comments. So to that extent, I think we are adequately covered by what has been presented. One can just highlight that the insolvency thing itself already exists in South Africa. We like to repeat that. It's just that this group of people who earn in the region of 7,500 a month and who owe around 50,000 rand cannot afford it. Anybody else who earns above this group is able to go to court and ask to be declared insolvent. So every business person, companies and everything are able to do this. But this category is not able to, because they cannot afford legal fees. So I think that is the main thing, that when you're talking about privation of property, it's like you're talking about taking somebody's property. But in actual fact, you are talking about bad debts, which companies write off voluntarily, regularly, because it makes no sense for them to put good money to chase bad money, to spend too much money chasing something that you cannot recover, like trying to squeeze blood from a stone. So this is what business ordinarily does. But this would provide relief to the vulnerable who cannot take it up for themselves, because first they cannot afford it, and then the companies of the credit providers already would see to it that they write those debts off, but it would be on their own volition and not in a structure. So this process will basically facilitate that this be done for the vulnerable as it is already available for those who can help themselves. I think that would be the only highlight to make. So,
thank you very much. Honourable members, I was hoping that we would have a revolutionary morality where there wouldn't be a need to be looking at people that have become indebted. But that's the reality of our economic system, our economic situation. And we're trying to find a way in which we can mitigate that as best we can, considering the rights of all people affected by this. The Honourable Faber had his hand raised. Can I have an indication whether there's any other hands? The Honourable Faber, the Honourable Mahwebo, let's have the Honourable High and then have you as the last two hands. So we'll have the Honourable Faber, who's from the Northern Cape, the Honourable Mahwebo, who is from Eastern Cape, the Honourable Chai, who's from Eastern Cape, then we'll have the Honourable Terblanche, who is from Western Cape, and the last hand will be from the Honourable Dikhale, who is our princess from the Popo.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, yes, and I think I've heard this through some of the speakers here, and specifically about the vulnerable people, and this is what I want to talk about. The fact is that this will increase the cost of credit for low-income earners. This is a fact. We cannot look past that. I would want to know how we will look at that. And then when we look at the illegal lenders, I think this will also then weaken the fight against these, what we call cash sharks or money sharks, etc. And the credit, then as well, it will also disrupt the credit market while posing a financial risk to state. This was also that I picked up. Now, Chairperson, another thing. When we look at this and we read through it, it says that The committee decided on 7,500 rand or less. Now why not 5,000? Which study was done to determine that it must be 7,500 rand? There are people that might have 8,000 rand. How was this determined? Did someone do a thumb sucking and say, we decide now it's 7,500. What studies was done on that? And then as well, the financial implications to the credit market are yet to be costed. We cannot come here today and hear that there was a cost comparison and in the UK. You cannot compare the UK to South Africa. Dynamics is totally different. I think that to me, that kite doesn't fly. You cannot compare the two to each other. Then as well, let me just, I don't have my glasses in, I write so badly. I would like to know, this could also result in the write-off, from what I've read, between 13.2 and 20 billion of debt, which is the total amount of the debt following under the debt extinguished provisions of the bill. Now, Chairperson, where will this come from? We are already in an economic crisis as we are. Now, to me, looking at this, and since we've been busy with the bill, reading from all of this, it is quite clear to me that this will actually increase people who are not able to make debt, to actually increase, because they will see that they can actually make debt, and according to this regulations, if it's under the law, you can get away with that, and we will put people actually in more trouble than they are. Then lastly, Chair, I read this, that the banking industry itself, which I believe is quite a substantial thing to say, which they're saying the banking industry is opposed to the proposal on the grounds that it will result in a restriction of credit to the low-income section of the market, and that the extinguished of debt represented an unconstitutional deprivation of poverty. It would also mean that credit providers would have to price in the additional risk. This is what I was talking about in the beginning, that it will increase the cost of low-income earners. Now, Chairperson, I would like to have answers on that, because we can talk nice things this way and that way around, but here are some factual things that we have to address that is not being addressed. Thanks, Chair.
Robert Faber, you raised 5 questions. I want to say that we are following a process. I'm not going to allow where we raise questions that we have raised at the initial stage of the bill. We are looking at the responses that we have here. And that's what we're going to concentrate on. So I end up with 2 questions for you. Because the questions that you're raising about the 7,500, how they've arrived at that, that has been explained to us already. When you mentioned the UK as an example, and the DGG may want to speak to that precisely, but you've spoken to it, advocate has spoken to it generally. Then the funding, there has been lots of time spent on where the alternative funding is going to come from, so I ruled that one out. In terms of the practicalities as well, therefore I have just concluded that first session by giving the opportunity to both the NCR and the NCT to say to us how practicable is it, and they have given us the assurance that they will do it. They can do it. They've said it's going to be complicated, so we agree with you it would be complicated, but they've said it is practicable. It can be done. In terms of the banking industry, there has been a response on that, but the advocate, I'm just going to ask you to be very brief in responding to that one on the banking industry, because we will consider that as part of the presentations that are before us. Honorable Mahwebo.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just 3 things quickly, and I just need clarity. I need clarity on them. Just the process of this bill. Advocate, this is for you. I know this is a committee bill, but I'm struggling to understand this process, because Any bill can be introduced, obviously, it would be by the member, the committee, the ministry. So to me, it's just the process of, by law, introduction of the bill. Because I'm sitting in a situation where ideally I would have loved to see the stakeholder. What you have done, you summarize these issues they've raised. And I don't know how they've raised them, how detailed they were. But you give us 3 lines and 4 lines. And to me, I struggle with that. I was hoping today, Chair, we'll be sitting with Nebben across the table. We'll be sitting, but we'll summarize these stakeholders' inputs for us. I am not sure why I am uncomfortable with that, and I'm not happy with that. Let me be frank.
No, but Bebo, you're not being fair. Those inputs were shared with us more than 7 days
ago.
We have had them. If there's particular questions on the input, as Honorable Faber has done it, you can then raise it or highlight the particular elements. But not to say you've not seen it, and to expect us in this meeting to work through this big pack of presentations. It's not fair.
Chair, I think you didn't catch me. I am not saying I have not seen them. I am saying I would ideally prefer that, having read what they've submitted, as a process, they'll sit across the table and say, we've read what you said, these are the issues I want clarity on their own, not somebody having worked for us. That's what I'm saying, and I'll leave it there. That's what I'm saying, as we have done previously with all other views. But secondly, let's leave that because we'll never agree on that one. Secondly, on the issue of mandatory life insurance, you've indicated that the ministry will introduce or, you know, promulgate regulations to ensure that what has been raised by the financial markets or the net ban in particular in this instance is covered, that is the mandatory life insurance. These regulations will be introduced by the minister. I mean, in through the regulations, the minister will cover this. My question then is, because you're saying that the regulations will ensure that there is an insurance product. Now, who's going to develop this insurance product? Will it be left to the markets? You know, then the minister will just say, look, well, I need clarity on this insurance product, because right now it's not clear for me. Who's going to introduce? I know the regulations to ensure that it's done, but who'll do it? Then lastly, will be on the financial literacy program. You know, one sits here today and remembering perhaps who would be affected by this. We keep calling them the vulnerable, which is correct, but these are the ordinary goggles in the villages, or ordinary men and women who have a level of, their literacy is very low, and hence the 7,500 to 50,000. So that's just my view, and I'm asking you to tell me if I'm wrong. I'm thinking, it's going to affect those who cannot read the English that we are using to develop this document, the financial literacy program. Now, here is my question. How ready are you to have this financial literacy program in all level official languages to make sure that people are able to understand this program? Because they drop the ball, people, because I want to believe they lack financial literacy. Now, if you want to educate them, you must remember, we are not educating matriculants. You'll be educating those perhaps who have never been to school, but they can speak. So are you ready for this? Will you be starting from scratch on financial literacy program, or you will be expanding on something that you already have? And how are you going to bring this program? Because I thought I had you talks from this institution saying, presentation, you'll be appointing a financial literacy, what you call it, officials, right? Now, do you have them, or are you starting from zero, even from there, start recruiting financial literacy officials, or you have them? And if so, how big is your pool of financial literacy officials who will be doing this? Because the law simply says this financial literacy is compulsory for all applicants. So if this law, if this bill were to be law tomorrow, one wants to find out, are you ready to have this program? That's to implement this law. In a manner that it makes sense, unlike people chewing, because you still have to recruit and find whatever needs to be found to be done. And thank you.
The Honourable High Place. Thank you, sir. I think mine also is on the issue that Mr. Marco is raising with regard to training. I'm worried about the resources for the training. The doc is more referring to the cooperation and generosity of other bodies to ensure this training. I'm a bit worried
speak about that, because you might not take a cooperation, because they are not obliged to, you know, to support this, you know, the process of change. I was just thinking whether, I know the both of you are raising this issue of labor Germany, and therefore it should be another process altogether. But I'm just thinking that another committee which has the same membership was recently dealing with the competition amendment bill, where the commission, competition commission, when it penalizes those who are infringers, I'll put it that way, there would be monies that are penalized. But that would go to the national fiscal. But there's an arrangement with Treasury that some of the money should go back to the competition commission. For example, there was a specific point that was raised that those money went to the issue of agri-processing. So I was just thinking if a similar arrangement could not be made, where I see that in the, though it is not in the old act, but in this new amendment, it talks about 10% of a turnover. I'm just thinking if I assume therefore that 10% will go to the national fiscal, or would it go to the national fiscal, if we can clarify that. Because in this bill, it talks about the 10%, 10 turnover. Where would that 10% then go? Would it go to the national fiscal, or would it go to the department, or to the national, or to the NCR? Wherever it goes, but I'm just checking whether there could be no arrangement that that 10% be used for funding of a training. But also the proactiveness of the training. Shouldn't wait for the applicant first to be in debt, and therefore there's this intervention measure, and then there's the counseling, and then there's the training, and then there's the certificate. Isn't it as possible to be proactive even before this group of 7.5 and 50,000 be on regular basis get this financial training to avoid them even getting involved in the debts that in the long run they won't be able to pay. And the majority of this 7.5, I assume, will be members of the trade unions. Wouldn't be proactive to link up with those trade unions so that training, it should also even be part of their training programs, invite you to conduct this training so that we avoid even this getting into this so that's the point of the situation. The former trade union, that's not, I'm going to say you must also go to the churches on the road and blood.
Jefferson, thank you, and may I start by asking your forgiveness. I see that you've been very strict with the other people. I don't have, you know, I wasn't part of the process thus far, and so please forgive me. I'm going to ask, you know, just let me mention general comments. Chairperson, I want to start where, I think it's the DDG, the Honorable Doctor there. You know, obviously we have an obligation to protect our people, and specifically the ones that, you know, she indicated. But Chairperson, I'm also a business person. I'm in business myself, and sitting here, I'm a very concerned person. I think that the things that got raised by my colleagues are very valid. Somebody is going to pay for this. And you know, one very wise man once said the following: the best government is the least government. Government intervention should be limited to the least possible impact. That is just the general comment. why, you know, we are dealing with, you know, we are sitting with a position with, you know, we are against the physical cliff. And yet again, and you know, obviously also we are having a bloated government service, and yet again we are going to add some government officials somewhere. And what worries me even more, Chairperson, the very people that we want to assist, I am concerned that they are going to bear the brunt of the unforeseen consequences that we're going to have. Obviously, it will be more difficult for them to access loans in future. And if they do, it's going to be more expensive to them. But let's just for one moment dwell on those that will not be able to access any loans. You know what is going to happen, Chairperson? The unregulated part. You know, maybe we should be giving them some new name now. You know, we refer to them in the past as loan sharks. I don't know what the new ones are going to be. Because obviously people cannot access loans now in future to the extent that they've been able to in the past. And the people that is going to fill that gap is going to come with conditions even more, even worse than the ones that they've faced before. Chairperson, is going to raise the cost, and, you know, is also going to raise the cost of doing business. It's going to impact on small business entrepreneurs. And I'm very concerned, Chairperson, but I, you know, obviously I trust the process that you've been following, and I'm also trusting that this committee has applied their mind for the department, but Chairperson, just in conclusion, I'm not a very comfortable chappy sitting here tomorrow, this morning. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I think your initial comment was very helpful. You were not here, so you wouldn't want to process something that you're not completely informed and comfortable with.
Thank you.
Honorable Dikhale will be the last from the floor.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I was part of those who were here last time, but I'm going to request that you apologize, you pardon us. I want to apologize that sometimes our minds get a serious attention, that we just focus somewhere instead of being in here, but physically in here. So whatever I'm going to ask, if ever I'm not supposed to, you just pardon me, and I also request that they respond to my question. I'm saying this because I want to touch on the issue that was touched by the Honorable Faber when it comes to the debt intervention criteria on page 8, whereby the committee did not give any explanation or supporting evidence when it comes to 7,500 and 50,000. My worry is that the president's minimum wage is 3,500, and we are talking about 7,500 here. My question is, are we not going to try and fuel something that at the end of the day we're not going to even afford to extinguish, because the members will be withdrawing because of the salaries that they are getting? So my question is, well, it's from the National Assembly, but we're here in the NSUP. I just want to make a request that we also look onto this, because many people in our rural areas are not getting this amount. To the DDG, when it comes to the access for their low-income earners, I heard you talking about mentioning most areas whereby we will be able to get the information. But in our villages, in the rural areas, in Limpopo, we do not have post offices. We can get it maybe in one village. Out of 81, you find that we have only one post office. I was going to request that you insert, or you also include the traditional offices, tribal offices, whereby they will then go there almost every day in order to do their things, when they go to town opening their banks or via the offices, and I believe that's where they'll get the information. If you can include it, I'll be very happy. And the last question, Jefferson, I just want to check if ever they did manage to reply to people like Mr. Buthelezi, whereby they just thinking that all the debts should be cancelled and we shouldn't have any monitoring system. Whoever he is, I know he's saying, I did my submission and they will listen to me. So just want to check if ever they did get a reply as to how is this going to work. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Zikhale. Just on your last point about Mr. Buthelezi, the procedure that we follow is not to write back to those that have made submissions to us. Therefore, we have people like PMG and others here where they can then through either looking at Channel 408 or finding creative ways of following the procedures of the committee, get that type of feedback. It's not procedure for Parliament to write back to the individuals that have made submissions to us. You also heard that there are some stakeholders from the private sector who have their interest and are present in the meeting today to also pick up what are the responses generally, but also specifically to the submissions that they have made. Let me just add, before I give you an opportunity, the group from DTI with the advocate to respond to those questions, by saying that what has happened is that you have presented to us summaries of all these submissions that were made. We have done the same in the province that I am representing here, which is Gauteng. I'm sitting like a CTS chairperson, but I've been deployed by that. When we had the hearing in the sitting in Gauteng, and the members of the portfolio committee there were all repeating similar questions to what the members are raising here, but the one that stands out is related to the one of funding and also ensuring that we do not just produce legislation, but that we are sure that those that we are earmarking to benefit from this are in fact going to be privy to the requisite literacy so that they can access that. I'm convinced by what I have heard, but I'm just emphasizing it, that members of the legislatures are raising that continuously as a matter where we're saying we don't just want to introduce a law and it looks good. We want to make sure that it will be implemented. I don't know who is going to start with the answering session. Normally you have a boss from DTI. So Doc, are we starting with you then?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the insights from the different experiences, including from the provinces. It assists us with a broader context. There are questions that, if it's okay, I will maybe group them, not that I'm not respecting the different honourable members in terms of what they have said. There was a question around the moral hazard and the cost of this intervention. Honourable Blanche also raised it and your concern. And also Honourable Faber mentioned this as well in terms of the issue around the cost to the credit providers, to the private sector, to the banks and so on. And I will start with the UK business by the portfolio committee. From their experience, I do understand that South Africa is different from the UK. They found that there was no moral hazard and there was no cost that was incurred from that intervention. And I think also, if we take what Professor Maseko said regarding the current debt situation in South Africa, we have over-indebted consumers. And the industry is writing off debt on a daily basis anyway. So I'm not saying this to justify maybe not having a responsible process. However, the way we look at it is this. You are bringing in an intervention that is there to also assist those credit providers. This, in a way, if the processes are followed as they are supposed to be followed, as rigorous as they are, a consumer will be, at some stage, be able to pay something back. It's a restructuring process. And I think, in a way, it will also assist with responsible lending and responsible borrowing, especially now for credit providers aware of this process. It might reduce the extent of reckless lending, where they just give money to people that are not able to pay. So we think that as much as there are risks that are being foreseen regarding the process, it might actually level the playing field. And I think, just to give more comfort, the bill introduces different review mechanisms. What we are talking about is potential losses or potential costs, but there may be, like in the UK case, a situation where this intervention actually works. So we will be doing a review of this process and just see the impact. At this stage, we think that there is a need to allow the process to see how it is going to work, but we don't foresee the cost implications, and we do understand the concern of industry to say it might lead to that. But I think there are safeguards that have been put in the bill in terms of the review mechanism to just check the impact going forward. And I think, in a way, this will really improve responsible lending practices, because currently credit is being given. You know that a particular consumer is likely not to pay, but a credit provider extends the credit anyway. So we think that it will be an intervention that will also try to assist the credit market in terms of the responsibility element between the consumers and the credit providers. And in terms of the 7,500 concern that has been raised also by honorable members, this was not an arbitrary number. It was not arbitrary. There were certain presentations made by industry, debt counselors, that indicated the thresholds that they use to determine applicants in terms of their support. And that assisted the portfolio committee to work out the numbers. And I think also the research from National Treasury assisted. So there were researchers that came into the portfolio committee, including the one that Advocate mentioned, that gave the committee an indication of how to pitch the amount. And I think that overall, there is a target market that is currently not supported. And on the issue of 7,500 versus 3,500, the point here is that from 7,500 and below, including 3,500, we are looking at all those consumers. So it's just the entire group from that amount until the whatever amount below. So I think that question around 3,500 is covered. Then when we come to the training related, Honorable Haji, you mentioned the issue around the 10%, the Competition Commission mechanism. It's something that I think we can explore, but I think in terms of the money bill implications, we didn't look at measures to look at how to use the bill to extract funding, but it's something that we haven't thought about, we haven't like engaged upon, but it's a... We want more money, you're right, and we cannot just rely on support from partnerships and MOUs. And I did mention that we have this payment distributing agency interest. So with the NCR functions, they have a payment distributing agency, one of their registrants, and there is an interest-bearing account they have that generates money currently. So it's an additional source. And we are considering using it for financial literacy. So in that sense, we're not just relying on the allocation by National Treasury. So that's something that we're also looking at. It's existing, it's there, it's bearing interest. So we have a source already. But you are right, it's not good to always come up with a law depending on external sources that are not even confirmed. So we have something. And we are also looking at registration fees. From what I understand, the fees have not been increased as the norm would be, where every year there's an increase as per inflation. So that's another avenue we are going to explore. So there will be other sources that we are looking at. So the what you have mentioned is something that we'll explore as well, just to see how that works and how we can maybe. But if it has money bill implications, it's definitely something that we will not be able to address, but we can explore that. We need more ideas, so this will help. And the proactive approach on the training financial literacy, the mechanism currently is based on what we have, on debt intervention, but you are correct. With over-indebtedness in the country, there should be ongoing capacity building of our consumers. Some even go to an extent of talking about at schools, even at universities, because that's where the debt spiral starts. Before even learners graduate, they're already over-indebted. So I think NCR already has some programs or some initiatives around this, but there's nothing wrong with intensifying your efforts. I think that is a good idea. But in terms of the bill, the issues are already, the financial literacy is already catered for in the context of this intervention. But over and above that, we should look at wider financial literacy across the board for all consumers. I think it's Prof. Maseko always says that we are also consumers. It doesn't mean as a prof, he's also a consumer, and or Ms. Mutahari as a CEO. You find CEOs and DDGs and DGs who are over indebted, borrowing petrol money. So the assumption is that it's about this target group, but this affects everyone. So financial literacy is for everyone. So I think it's something that we can look at. And there were questions around the life insurance, mandatory life insurance, whether there is there a product. NCR will elaborate further on this, but as far as I understand, there are products in the market currently, but then this area can be strengthened. And we also have the concurrency with National Treasury. We have credit life insurance for other credit. So this is just going to be more, just to capacitate the bill to be able to work around this, even for more products that can be more specific to this group. But it's not a new thing per se, but they will assist me in terms of clarifying further. And in terms of the levels, in one of the previous portfolio committee meetings, we elaborated to the committee that we want to make sure that this process is accessible to all everyone in the country. So language issues are also important. And we will look at how to make it accessible. I know that the NCR has employed someone who is currently looking at a plan around this. So accessibility and simplicity becomes important. And I think in terms of implementation, this will be strengthened. Advocates, including in the bill, we are indicating that this intervention will not be available immediately because it requires time for preparation, like any other legislation. You need to prepare your industry, you need to prepare regulations. So these are the things that we will be able to look into going forward. And another thing we are also balancing is to start implementing before the law is signed. Then you start, let's say we start spending now, and then the law, or something happens, it does not come, then it's another issue. So we need to balance between the actual acting now versus the actual finalization of the law, to balance that we don't incur costs and then eventually there are other consequences. So we are trying to manage that, but we will ensure that by the time the law comes into effect, the readiness level is quite high. That's something that we'll also look into. And regarding the accessibility of post offices in other areas, Honorable Dikhale, you will look into that because you are right. Not every area has similar infrastructure. So it means that our net must be wider in terms of ensuring that where there are no post offices, we look at what else can be utilized to look into consumers who are in far distant locations, who are not able to access the mechanism. So, Chair, I think from the issues that were raised, these were most of the issues. I hope I didn't leave out anything. And I think that my colleagues will assist with the others that I might have left out. Thank you.
Thank you, CEO.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I just want to add on to what Dr. Masoja spoke to. Honorable Dikhale, you did indicate that it's important for us to be able to access, you know, consumers in rural areas. And as I hear already, I mean, there are a number of community outreach programs that we are involved in. We've been to a lot of villages, you know, in various provinces, and we worked through tribal authorities to be able to do that. What we are also seriously considering at the moment as the NCR, even before this bill, is that we want to start investing in mobile offices. And it's something that we want to start doing now with the work that we have, because we also want to make sure that we enhance our communication to consumers in various areas of the country. So but mobile offices is another mechanism that we are seriously considering at the moment. Now, in terms of the, there's been a lot of concerns around the fact that this bill is going to increase costs for this, you know, low-income group, and there's going to be restricted access to this group. I did indicate that at the moment debt cancelling works, but debt cancelling is only accessible to people who earn more than 7,500 a month. These people don't have any debt relief mechanism that is available to them. And through the debt intervention bill, we will be able to, credit providers will at least be able to get some money back. At the moment, consumers, because they know there's no, you know, there's no law in place, they're not able, they're not even able to pay back, you know, what they owe credit providers. So we are going to make it better for consumers to be able to, credit providers to be able to get some money back through this restructuring. We did say that when we receive applications at the NCR, the first thing that we will do is to make sure that we do, you know, we perform a debt cancelling function. And because this info, this service will be provided free of charge, some money, at least, you know, a lot of these consumers will be able to pay back money, the money that they owe to some credit providers, even if it may not necessarily be the actual amount owed, but at least some money will be paid back. So, you know, I just want, you know, everybody to understand that it's a mechanism that is very important for credit providers as well as consumers. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Just a few from my side, because I think everybody everything material has already been responded to. But I just prepared my answers instead of rewriting the questions that were asked, so maybe they'd be grouped or overlapped. But I wanted to point out that we envisage that in this process we will have the same experience as we are doing in debt counseling applications at the tribunal. Most of these applications, the credit providers and the consumers agree on how to pay going forward, reduced fees and all of that. The problem was at the beginning when both of them didn't understand how the system would work, and eventually they realized that what the debt counselor does is it just facilitates between them a discussion of how to restructure the debt. And after a long while now, a huge percentage of these cases just come through by agreement. Very few get fought out in full-blown court hearings at the tribunal. So most of them will process them as consent orders. They consent and bring to make it an order of the tribunal. Now you're talking here about 2,000 of those cases a month, and about 24,000 per annum, those that come through from that stream. So the credit providers and the debt counselors and the consumers do structure deals. They facilitated by the debt counselor. We now expect that for this component, the insolvency component, will be facilitated by the officers of the National Consumer Regulator, and we think it will take the same pattern. It will be difficult at the beginning when they are learning how this works, but eventually, because it helps also the credit providers to what is it that they had to write off with the cooperation of an external facilitator, rather than what is happening now, because now it's a typical process for them to say we write this off or we don't write this off. They end up chasing money that's really useless with high legal costs. You'll find that they've briefed one firm of attorneys to chase this book, this list of debts. But for some of them, they spend 5,000 rand to get 500 rand from this person and or not get it. So if it is facilitated and it's formalized, it will help both sides to reach the same conclusion with a totally facilitated process. And when they differ, when there's a disagreement, it is when they will come to the tribunal and fight it out there with the officer of the National Consumer, NCR, to say, no, we don't agree with your analysis or we don't agree with your calculations. Then the tribunal must come and arbitrate that particular matter. The other thing is that since about, we think about 90% of these applications will be by agreement. There is no expropriation of property in this case. It's always going to be facilitated because the credit provider is always going to be involved from the beginning. When this person comes to the NCR and says, I want to apply for this debt intervention, the NCR will immediately contact all the credit providers and they will make their own presentations to the NCR officer. And from there, when by the time they come to tribunal, either they have all agreed as to what it's going to be, or they are fighting it out and they all oppose each other, then we have a full-blown court hearing where they can bring their attorneys and representatives. And the consumer, the difference is that will be assisted by that debt intervention officer from the NCR, who will stand in the same place that a debt counselor stands in debt review cases. So I think we just need to paint that picture so that it's very clear. And we don't think that there will be an abuse of the system by the consumers. I think the Honorable Member Faber was worried about that. This is because the system punishes the consumer as well. If you go through the bill properly, you know, with a magnifying glass, you will see that they cannot access credit while they are under that process until they are rehabilitated, if they are rehabilitated. And that rehabilitation is a process itself, and it will be fought out by the credit providers all the way until it is done as well. So at every stage, you have the credit provider involved, either agreeing because they are seeing things from the same perspective, or disagreeing until that party arbitrates otherwise, which will be the tribunal in this case. So it's not like the NCR will stand in a corner and scribble on a piece of paper and say, we're writing off that debt, and that's it. It will be a thoroughly fought out process from the beginning to the end. And we already have that experience happening in the debt review. It's just that this one is another leg of relieving the debt and on both sides. What was the other thing? Well, yeah, it was the issue of loan sharks, by whatever name they will have, perhaps thriving because of this. We don't think that will be the case, because this bill also, in another part, is making this lending now a criminal offense, which means there will be jail terms now. There will be people going to jail for lending without being registered, as the advocate said when she started. I know that she was speaking fast, and perhaps we were not referring to sections of the reading them. She was referring to them by name, but we did not read them, so maybe members sort of short past that, but she did allude to the fact that it's now going to be an offense to lend. You're no longer just going to be taking them to jail for taking ID cards and ATM cards and all that, but just for the lending itself, they will be able to be punished. And I think, therefore, that should allay the the worries perhaps that members have raised. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you very much, Prof. Maseko. Advocate, you have the last one.
Thank you, Chair. I think there's just two questions that have not been addressed. The first one was, it, to some extent, was addressed about the regulations on the life insurance and about who will develop that product. It has been indicated that there are currently products on the market, but the bill makes it very clear that the Minister of Trade and Industry must consult with the Minister of Finance before the Minister of Trade and Industry can make these regulations. And the reason for that is specifically so that the Minister of Finance can give input on whether this is viable for the market to do. So the Minister of Finance will play quite a big role there. Then just also, there was some comment about the method used in the Competition Commission, the Competition Amendments Bill, and the indication was that the department will look at that. But I thought just to clarify with members that any money like that has implications in respect of the Public Finance Management Act. So there's specific processes that must be followed. So money must go back to the fiscus if it doesn't, you know, so there's all these kind of implications. So it is something that can be looked at, but there will quite likely have to be further changes to legislation. Alternatively, through the Minister of Finance, it can be done via your allocation. And then, Chair, if you would just allow me, I think that this committee might have done this process before, but I don't know if it was explained. This bill is a Section 76 bill. So the voting process is through mandates coming from the provinces. This public participation, facilitation of public participation process that is happening now is something that is very new. And it is something that is causing a bit of a practical problem for the support staff, and I think that your secretary will speak to that. But how do we deal with this going forward? So all of these stakeholders will be consulted in the provinces individually, because that is where the voting on this bill actually happens. And these submissions, practically speaking, the only way that we could think of how to give them their rightful place is for them to be given to every member to take to their provinces, so that their provinces can look at the report that this committee will do following this participation process. Because the Constitutional Court has indicated that this process is not necessary. This committee can do the necessary consultation as required by the Constitution through the provincial legislature. It was then a decision from the support to the committees that this is a process that we must maybe look at to empower committees further. So like I'm saying, it is something that's not constitutionally required, and it is going to cause a bit of it is causing in more than one committee a bit of a practical problem, because it does not inform voting here, because the voting happens elsewhere. So yeah, it is a bit of a learning curve still. We are still struggling on what is the best process, thinking about balancing all the rights of people involved. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I'm going to call it to a close now. I just want to make one comment before I explain the process. Honourable Dr. Blanche.
Sorry for this. I just have one follow-up question, if you are going to allow me.
I'm going to...
just for the sake, I'm new here.
No, because you knew. No, because you knew. I'm going to tell you what we do, Honorable Lavanche, is people don't run away from here. They're going to be standing outside. We normally follow up on questions with them. Then they can do more justice too. I'm worried about our time. Because you insist. I'll listen you out and see whether I thank you for understanding. But Honorable Tamaj, I'm serious when I do say that it doesn't end here. In the presentation that has been done for us by Advocate, we say it's a long process. I will go into detail on that now. The first is just to clarify this thing of the regulations. Honorable Mahwebo. It's not like the minister sits at night and writes the regulations. No. Come on, man. There are consultations that happen. With the regulations, we've mentioned the consultations with the Treasury. But there's also going to be consultations with the National Consumer Tribunal, with the National Credit Tribunal, and those commissioners as well. There is going to be consultation because the minister would have to refine those regulations based on the experience of these people that are on the ground. So those consultations happen with the regulations. We shouldn't be too anxious about that. And then we have the staff within the DTI as well. You see, sometimes we call them the stakeholders. So Dr. Masoja here will be sitting in that meeting with the commission and with the tribunal and looking at what is it that comes out of that. There'll be a draft of the regulations that goes to them and goes back to the minister. The minister doesn't consult with the tribunal himself or the deputy minister, they delegate. That's point one. Point two, the point raised by the advocate about the process. Honourable members, I'm, unlike the advocate, not anxious about the committee staff. I have here before me a report that Lubeka has already done, which is a report of the Select Committee on Trade and International Relations on the National Credit Amendment Bill B32/2018, dated 28th of October 2018. I'll give you the summary. The Select Committee on Trade and International Relations have considered the submissions of the National Credit Amendment Bill and reports as follows. The Select Committee received written submissions of the bill from the following stakeholders, and all 15 stakeholders are mentioned here. Point two is what we've done today, which is the analysis and the submissions. Therefore, to make sure that we do justice to that, the document that advocate presented to us then goes as an appendix with this letter to the provinces. And then point three is the recommendation. The select committee is of the view that the submissions and subsequent consideration thereof added value to the deliberations on the bill and recommend that the members of the select committee relay these deliberations to their respective provincial legislatures to be considered during the negotiating mandates process that is presently underway. Honorable Dihale, can I ask you to hold me now? We're going to need you for the minutes. I'm only going to take 2 minutes of your time, please. But we need a quorum to adopt the minutes. I'm terribly. Had I known you need to run, I would have put the minutes before this. But this is an important process. So, honourable members, I'm putting this report, which has the three elements. Let me go through it again. The one is the submissions that have been, the name of the submissions. The second is this document. And the third is that we're asking our provincial legislatures to give us a mandate. All right? The mandate says yes or no. Right. Are we in agreement that we can go ahead with that process? Any objections to that? No objections. Okay. Then, Rebecca, I don't need to sign that now. Oh, I must sign. The third thing that I quickly want us to give attention to, honourable members, is the minutes. We have three sets of minutes, and because it's our last meeting for the year, it's honourable Dikhame, that I don't want us to disperse without looking at this. It's the meetings of the 31st of October, where we had a briefing by the Department of Tourism on its annual report. There is nothing controversial in there. Could look at a proposal for the acceptance of that. The members that were present there was Ntebe, Faba, Mahwebu, and Matebula. Honorable Matebula, if you prepared to propose, I will second. There was nobody else there. You move for that. Okay, thank you very much. You may take it. No. Don't you want to? I need a paper. Okay, I'll sign later. The second one, honorable members, is the meeting of the 14th of November, the ratification of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. That was presented to the House yesterday. We were all welcoming of that presentation. It was the shortest meeting that we ever had. The members present were the Honorable Khai, Ntebe, Pakis, Faba, Mahwebu, and myself. Honorable Khai, proposes? Honorable Mahwebu?
There's a correction date.
Correction? Oh. Yeah. The date there.
That's
the 2018. Yeah. Sorry, I saw it when I read it. I'm running so fast that I forget. It's in the concluding paragraph. I'll show it to you now. With that correction, are you prepared to propose acceptance, Honorable Han?
Yes.
Thank you. Honorable I would need to second that as well. I was other person there. The final one, Chair, honorable members, is the meeting of 7th of November, which is the briefing by DTI on the ratification of the agreement establishing the African Continental Free Trade Area and also the investment and finance protocol that was also presented to the House yesterday. I'm mentioning the House because you've heard the summaries in the House.
Correction, sir.
Yes, madam?
I would like the Honorable Secretary to correct that I was not absent, but I rendered an apology. I was having a meeting in the Chairperson's office for the Secretary of the President. So
I'm thorough with my apologies. If we didn't receive an apology in writing, it's not an apology.
Sure, you did.
We didn't, madam. I always check with
you, Secretary.
Okay, we will check it again. We will check it again. Rebecca will check this part. Because if you gave it in writing, I know what you normally do.
Yes.
You bring us a letter to the meeting. You know, start bringing us a letter. So it's going to be easy to trace that. Okay, we will look at that. With that correction, the members present were Khai, Ntebe, Mtlanga, Kaula, and myself. So Honorable Khai, it's you and I. Because these women, you see, have more duties than men, so they can't just sit in these meetings. Okay, so it's Honorable Khai and myself. Honorable members, I thank you very much. Just the final thing that I would want to repeat is that the SEZ in Atlantis will be launched next week. The minister has invited me as chairperson of the committee. I will unfortunately no longer to attend because I've just been deployed by the chief whip to meet one of my other responsibilities, which is to participate in the meetings of the World Trade Organization. I've just looked at my email, got my ticket while I'm sitting here. I'll be traveling next week on the 4th to attend that. So, no, I never travel alone. I wanted to wish you a blessed festive season and trust that our time with our families will be quality time and we'll come back next year filled with love and joy. Thank you very much.
Thank you.